Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled Pregnancy and Rare Neuroimmune Disorders. My name is Gigi DeFebri, and I will be moderating this podcast with Ashley Olson. Ashley, do you mind introducing yourself?
Hi, my name is Ashley Olson. I'm 35 years old, and I started developing symptoms in 2004 after giving birth to my son. I later went on to have my daughter in 2012, and that's when I decided to make it my mission to advocate and educate the community on NMO and MOG. I also run a website called nmochat.com where you can read all sorts of different literature on both diseases.
Thank you so much, Ashley. We're so happy you were able to join us today. Just to give some background information, the TMA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Michael Levy and Dr. Riley Bove. Dr. Michael Levy is an associate professor of neurology and the medical director of general neurology at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Levy specializes in taking care of patients with neuroimmunologic diseases, including multiple sclerosis, transverse myelitis, optic neuritis, and neuromyelitis optica. In the laboratory, Dr. Levy's research focus is on the development of neural stems for regenerative therapy in these diseases. He uses rat and mouse models to test the survival, differentiation, and functional capacity of human neural stem cells to improve neurologic function in post-inflammatory conditions. The goal of his laboratory and clinical effort is to translate the basic science stem cell work to a human trial in transverse myelitis and other neurologic diseases. Dr. Riley Bove has a rich experience at the intersection of neurological health and society. Her first academic passion was anthropology, which she pursued at Harvard College and through a Fulbright grant in Mali. She obtained her medical degree from Harvard Medical School in 2007, completed her residency in the combined Massachusetts General Hospital, Brigham and Women's Hospital Neurology Program, and an MS Clinical Research Fellowship at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and a master's degree through Harvard Medical School's Clinical Investigator Training Program. She's received research support from the NIH, the National MS Society, and the California Initiative to Advance Precision Medicine, among others. Dr. Bove is board certified in neurology. She joined the UCSF faculty in 2015, where she primarily works to expand access to care and improve function for people living with multiple sclerosis. Her son was affected with acute flaccid myelitis, or AFM, in 2014, and she's also committed to advancing work in the prevention of AFM and care of children affected by it. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to try to have this start kind of from the, you know, conception and what goes into thinking about when you're conceiving to actual pregnancy and then after pregnancy. So Dr. Bove, I know this question kind of might differ based on the disorder we're talking about, but how long should someone be stable before trying to conceive?
Yeah, good morning, everybody, and thanks for having me here with you. So the definition of stability really kind of it comprises two separate pieces. One of those pieces is whether the condition itself is stable in terms of a person not experiencing relapses or attacks, and the other piece is how well the person is doing overall. So when we think about whether the condition is stable, and let's take the example of neuromyelitis optica, ideally a woman would not have had a relapse in the last few months. She would have a stable plan in terms of how to transition medications if she were on medications, and she would not be sort of getting steroids for a relapse. We used to say that, you know, in the MS world, which a lot of the information that we'll talk about today has been extrapolated a little bit from the MS or multiple sclerosis world, just because there are more patients and more is known. We used to say that women with MS should wait a certain amount of time after a relapse, but I would say there's no good amount of time. There's no hard and fast rules about waiting 6 months or 12 months or anything else. It's more how she's doing today and what her treatment plan is. In terms of the questions about how the woman is doing overall, you want to make sure, for instance, that the bladder function is okay or under control. You want to make sure that whatever can be done after a relapse to sort of optimize walking function has been done in terms of physical therapy. You want to make sure that the mom is doing okay from a mood and coping standpoint, that there's a plan in place for her to have the appropriate support as she's going through sort of the conception attempts, pregnancy planning, and the pregnancy, that the family is on board, and then also that she has a good doctor team, so a neurologist and also a obstetrician or a fertility expert on her side. And so that's sort of the sort of overall well-being stability that you want before planning conception.
Great, thank you so much. It's a really good overview. Dr. Levy, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I completely agree. First of all, thanks everyone for joining us on the podcast. It's always an honor to be part of this. But to answer that question, I agree. I don't think there's any specified time that you have to demonstrate that you're stable. You just have to be, you know, able to tolerate all the things that go into being pregnant, and exactly as Dr. Bove said.
Okay, Dr. Levy, would you recommend becoming pregnant naturally or artificially inseminated?
I would say that there's no big difference. If you can do it naturally, then that's fine. And if you require artificial insemination, that's fine too. I wouldn't say that there's any reason to pick one or the other based on the neurological issues.
Okay, thank you. And then Dr. Bove, is it harder for patients with these disorders to conceive? And does this differ kind of based on the disorder?
Yeah, so I think it does differ a little bit based on the disorder. And again, just really, want to make sure that we emphasize that we know more about NMO, neuromyelitis optica, and less about MOG or ADEM or the other conditions, more sort of rare conditions. So if we think a little bit about this, medications can affect fertility, and I know we'll talk about that in a little bit. A mom's sort of stress level and sort of overall well-being can affect her ability to conceive. And then there's also considerations about how long we sort of quote-unquote allow a couple to try to conceive before trying to optimize their fertility with artificial insemination. And so the complicating thing is, even though women may not have differences in their ability to conceive, which, you know, typically is defined, you know, infertility is defined by a year or more of trying, even though women may get there over a year, because you have to adjust medications and tend to other things, we may not want to let a woman, for instance, try a whole year before she conceives to get her help. And so I typically recommend that after about 6 months of trying, and sort of, you know, using the fertility calculators and, you know, ovulation predictors and things like that. After 6 months of trying, I do tend to have my patients see a fertility expert, just so that we can be making sure that if we needed that, we had a plan in place. And again, it's not because the fertility is necessarily going to be affected, but it's just that we don't let women go as long.
Okay, thank you. And then, is there a level of disability, you know, within these disorders that could potentially prevent someone from conceiving and carrying a child, or does that not have an effect, Dr. Bove?
So there's generally, you know, there's sort of the issue of sexual function, and then there's also sort of the issue of, walking and ambulation. So a lot of these disorders, especially ones that affect the brain as well as the spinal cord, can be associated with lower libido, lower mood, just because there is inflammation and a lot of things going on for women. And so, you know, some women may need a little bit of help in terms of their libido to get sort of down the path of conceiving a child. There can be a lot of pain sort of in the pelvic area, and so that can make sexual intercourse harder. And finally, you know, people always think about, well, you know, can you carry a pregnancy if you have a hard time walking? You know, what we've seen is like women can conceive, you know, if their sexual function is okay, they don't necessarily have to be walking well to be able to conceive and carry a child. Delivery itself, you know, there's a lot of thoughts, well, if a woman is, you know, legs are weak, could she actually deliver? A lot of the work of delivery is actually the uterus muscle, which is a very different type of muscle and like does a good job regardless of a mom's leg strength. And so there don't seem to be super clear reasons why a woman who has some difficulty with walking or numbness in her legs might not be able to get pregnant and also carry a child.
Now, Dr. Levy, is it possible that the medications that are taken prior to pregnancy, could it possibly make it harder to conceive a child?
With rituximab, no, I don't think that there is any issue there. With CellCept, the concern is not with fertility, but with the negative consequence on the fetus. And that, so that's a contraindication for pregnancies. Using CellCept, we recommend stopping the CellCept for at least 2 months before trying or switching to another therapy, obviously. But there is a drug called cyclophosphamide, which was used in the last decade and a lot more before that for treatment of especially acute relapses that were intractable. So these were cases where that didn't respond immediately to steroids and sometimes not even to plasma exchange. And a lot of people would get this medication, cyclophosphamide, in the hospital as the last ditch effort to get rid of the inflammatory process. And that medication can impact fertility. I think the risk is about 25%, maybe that high. And so we do offer egg harvesting and hormone therapy to women who are going to use cyclophosphamide because of that risk.
Okay. And what needs to be considered? I know, Dr. Bobe, you talked about this a little bit at the beginning, before someone becomes pregnant, you know, whether medications are would be harmful to a fetus or what, Dr. Bobe?
Yeah, I like to kind of parse that out into two pieces. One is the women who want zero drug on board, so who want to be absolutely sure that their fetus and sort of growing child would not be exposed to medications. And then sort of the other one is women where you're really weighing the risks and benefits of treatment versus fetal exposure. So when, you know, especially in California, where there's sort of a lot of focus on, you know, lack of drugs and sort of holistic care and things like that, you know, we do have patients who say, I don't care how low the risk is to my fetus, I want no drug on board, period. And so if you do that, and certainly with the most risky medications, you know, the rule of thumb is you wait 5 half-lives, okay? So a half-life, to define that term, is how long it takes for half the drug in your body to be eliminated by the kidneys or the liver. So if half-life is 20 days for a medication, which it is for Rituxan, if you wanted to wait 5 half-lives, that would be 100 days before you would be pretty much confident that there's no drug on board. Okay, so women who want to conceive with no drug on board should wait 5 half-lives. Women who kind of want to think through, you know, what are the risks? Does the drug cross the placenta in the first trimester versus third trimester? You know, what drug risk category is it? So the FDA used to have these categories A, B, C, D, where an X, where A was, you know,
certainly safe and X was no, no, no. You know, when you're thinking through that, it gets a little bit more on a drug by drug basis. So to give an example, one of the drugs that Dr. Levy brought up, and it's, you know, commonly used for NMO, Rituxan, has a half-life of about 20 days. So in about 3.5 months, it's out of the system completely. But the effect of the Rituxan on the B cells persists. So Rituxan attacks the B cells, and after a Rituxan infusion, the B cells are out of a patient's system for 6 or 9 months. So what that tells you is you have a time period where there's no drug in the mom's blood, but she's still treated for her condition. And so we call that type of medication a nice bridge before conception, because it gives mom a period of time where, again, she's treated and she can try to conceive, but without any concern about any potential risk to the fetus.
Now, Dr. Levy, which preventatives would you recommend during pregnancy?
I think that the best outcomes that I've seen in my patient population have been babies who were conceived and carried on rituximab. And I don't say that lightly. As physicians, we're always trained to be especially wary of treatment during pregnancy. And so when we started following patients on rituximab, most of those pregnancies were kind of accidental. And the observation at the time was, well, there doesn't seem to be too many problems here. And that wasn't the case with other medications like CellCept, where we recognized there was a problem. Azathioprine had been kind of the standard, but it was still what's called a class D by the FDA, which is, in animal studies, we know there are risks, but in humans, we're not quite sure. Prednisone was always on the list, but we know how chronic prednisone can cause long-term side effects. So we had this data with all these other drugs, and with rituximab, it just seemed to be not too bad. And so then we started following more and more patients and started recommending it more and more, and we still haven't seen anything that would raise any concern so far. But it's not like these studies have been done in any scientific, rigorous fashion. And so really, it's just based on these observations now at multiple centers that seems to be that rituximab doesn't really have that much of an effect, a harmful effect. Now, we know that when the rituximab is dosed in the mom during the second or third trimester, we know the rituximab crosses the placenta and can kill off the B cells in the fetus. The only monitoring we have is when the baby's born, we can check the B cell counts. And they seem to consistently repopulate within the first 2, 3, 4 months of life. And they're never born with zero B cells that we've seen. They're always maybe half, or there's always some missing, but they seem to come back pretty quickly. And we haven't really seen any concerning infections that you'd be worried about in a baby who's born without B cells. And these kids have gone to daycare and been exposed to normal everyday households. So based on just that observational experience, my preferred favorite is rituximab. And that's mostly because the alternatives are not my favorite. Azathioprine, CellCept, prednisone, they all have issues associated with them that we know about, whereas rituximab seems to be clean so far.
You know, if I may just jump in as an echo what Dr. Levy said, you know, we recently looked at sort of all the pregnancies reported for women treated with rituximab for a range of conditions, so autoimmune conditions, cancers, many different things. And we found just what Dr. Levy said from his rich experience is just that there did not seem to be a strong safety signal at all. We did see the babies being born with low B cells in some of the cases. They repopulated really quickly, but otherwise there was no major or no concerning safety signal. And so I would absolutely echo what he said about that being sort of a favorite approach.
Okay, now if somebody was unable to take Rituxan, what would the next preventative be recommended from one of you?
So I think it depends on the condition, and it depends what the condition does respond to. Where it's absolutely true that the steroids, for instance, long-term use of steroids has a lot of different side effects. In the MS world, a lot of people have used monthly steroids before a conception, during a pregnancy, and postpartum as sort of a temporary way of reducing the risk of inflammation. And, you know, the obstetric maternal fetal medicine world does think that steroids are quite safe when given during pregnancy, especially the second and third trimesters. So that is sort of a general option, even though it's not sort of a preferred, more focused option. Those would be, you know, that would be my second choice probably if a woman could not take rituximab.
I don't really have a second favorite, to be honest. I would tolerate anything else except CellCept, but you know, the Mayo Clinic still kind of advocates for azathioprine, so, and they have some pretty compelling reasons and experiential data as well. So I guess azathioprine would be second, or prednisone second, but I wouldn't be happy about either one of those as much as I would be with rituximab.
Okay, thank you. And I know that that has, you know, that's our discussion has been in the past few questions has been about, you know, controlling kind of future potential relapses. But Dr. Bo, what would someone do to treat, you know, if someone had something like, you know, an attack of transverse myelitis while they were pregnant? Would, you know, steroids be used, or plasma exchange, or IVIG, or are there special considerations with someone who is pregnant who is newly diagnosed with something like transverse myelitis?
Yeah, so steroids and IVIG have both been used in the MS world during pregnancy. Both have been considered okay and fairly safe. So IVIG throughout the pregnancy, steroids, it used to be that there was concern during the first trimester about things like cleft palate. It looks like that risk was probably overblown, and it's probably okay as well. But certainly in the second and third trimester, steroids or IVIG could be used for an attack.
Now, Dr. Levy, if your patient was on CellCept and wanted to conceive, how would the transition go from switching them to from CellCept to Rituxan?
That direction of a switch is easy because rituximab takes effect fairly quickly, within a few hours and certainly within a couple weeks. So the usual switch would be that you stay on the CellCept until you come in for your rituximab infusion, and then the day you get your first rituximab infusion, you can stop your CellCept. The CellCept will still take some time to wear off, and then a month or two later, when the CellCept has cleared and the rituximab is in full effect, that would be an ideal time.
Thank you. And then we did get a question, you know, live during this podcast about medications kind of during pregnancy to treat the symptoms that someone might have. For example, you know, spasticity medication or something like gabapentin or other kind of neuropathic pain medications. Are there any risks to taking these medications during pregnancy, Dr. Bove?
Yeah, so it really depends on the medicine. So as a general rule, a lot of the medicines that are used for fatigue, for the bladder, for spasticity, are category, sort of the old FDA categories C and D. That's where it's really important to have a good, and so just to define those are categories where there could be some risk to the fetus. Those categories are probably a little safe, a little too safe and conservative. And so this is really where you want the good conversation with your neurologist and your OBGYN to really think about the specific medicine and, you know, weighing the pros and cons. I mean, if the spasticity is overwhelming for the mom and the safety data are fairly weak, a mom might choose to go ahead. So for instance, baclofen and tizanidine are category C. So maybe there's a little bit of a safety signal, but definitely given quite commonly in pregnancy.
Now, Dr. Levy, would you recommend pregnant women receiving vaccinations?
Vaccinations can be fine. It depends on what it's for. For example, a flu vaccine is generally fine as long as you're on something like rituximab. The data that we have suggests that vaccinations are nothing but helpful. It prevents an infection. Infections themselves can trigger relapses. And as long as you're treated, the vaccines should not cause any problem. But if you decide that during your pregnancy you are not going to be on any preventive treatments, then a vaccine can activate the immune system and then trigger a relapse. So it depends on what you're taking. But if you're on rituximab, then a vaccine, especially with a type of vaccine that's called a recombinant vaccine, that's just a protein that's synthesized in the lab, like flu, the new shingles vaccine, and the pneumococcal vaccine, those are all fairly safe. And so those should be fine.
And Dr. Levy, is that just specifically for NMO or in general?
That's specifically for people who are on immune suppressing drugs.
Got it.
Who have a risk of relapse. So all those TM folks who don't necessarily have that risk of relapse that NMO patients have, that doesn't necessarily apply. In theory, TM patients have largely normal immune systems at this point, so assuming that there's no risk of that the risk of relapse has long elapsed. And so those patients should have normal immune systems and should be able to tolerate vaccines normally.
Got it. Okay. And a follow-up question about vaccinations. Can pregnant patients be around children who've been recently vaccinated, for example, their own children that maybe have had recent vaccinations, Dr. Bove?
So it depends a little bit if the vaccination is considered live or not, or killed. But in general, ideally vaccine should be done before a pregnancy. I don't know that I would necessarily recommend that a woman not be around her vaccinated children. What do you think, Dr. Levy?
I prefer a break from my children any chance I could get. So if a doctor prescribed it, I would take advantage of it personally. But no, seriously, I agree. I don't think there's any reason to avoid your children. There are a few vaccines that, like live vaccines, where the child can become infected and start to shed the virus. And in those conditions, the fetus is technically unprotected and could become exposed. But those occurrences are something like less than 1 per million. So I don't think it should be on anyone's radar necessarily.
Now, are women do they have a higher chance of miscarriages?
So we don't know. So we don't know that these conditions necessarily affect sort of first trimester issues, because you need really, really good studies to be able to figure out what happens in the first trimester. Unfortunately, so many routine pregnancies can sort of terminate during the first trimester for a range of reasons. And it's really hard to have good information. What we do have information on is that women with NMO may have a higher risk of preeclampsia. Preeclampsia being sort of a problem with the way that the placenta forms, and women can be at risk of high blood pressure, seizures in the brain, and then damage to the liver and other organs. And it does look like women with NMO may be at higher risk of preeclampsia, and that can definitely result in sort of, severe injury to the mom and also loss of the fetus. There may be a higher risk of sort of non-preeclampsia miscarriage as well in women with NMO, but it's just, we don't, the data are not so good yet. What that means is that, you know, sort of what we set up in the beginning is that women should have a good relationship with their neurologist and their obstetrician and make sure that things like blood pressure are being carefully monitored during their pregnancies.
Great, thank you. And Dr. Bogue, do you mind just talking a little bit about the potential, you know, is there a higher risk for relapse during pregnancy in someone with, you know, NMO or MOG, antibody-associated disease? And if there is, kind of when does this take place?
Yeah, so I can't speak much about MOG because I just don't have the personal caseload and there isn't enough information to guide us there, maybe there are some data from Hopkins, but in terms of the NMO piece, what we saw in women with multiple sclerosis is that during pregnancy, their immune system, which becomes what we call immunotolerant, so it becomes immunotolerant during pregnancy to allow this fetus to sort of, you know, the placenta to implant and the mom to tolerate sort of this kind of foreign fetus. We found that the immunotolerant state of pregnancy actually protected women with MS from relapses. We actually haven't found that in women with NMO. And in fact, we've seen that there are higher risk of relapses both during pregnancy and also postpartum. And so it is a sort of a time where they have to be followed very carefully.
Now, Dr. Levy, is there a higher risk for our fetus to develop abnormalities due to either the conditions or the medications?
As far as the condition goes, I'm not aware of any risk to the fetus. There was a study done on placentas that came from women who delivered, and they all had NMO. And there was some evidence in parts of the placenta that there was inflammation. And that sparked a concern that maybe this could be one way that NMO manifests outside of the nervous system. That hasn't been verified, reproduced, and we're not 100% sure that that inflammation was related to NMO. So as far as we can tell right now, NMO still seems to be confined almost exclusively to the central nervous system and not affect anything outside like the fetus. Medications, however, are systemic, and we know CellCept is associated with, it's a 7% risk of cleft lip or palate, and so that's the one, the major one that we want to avoid. With rituximab, we don't think that there are any consequences. Prednisone, of course, everybody knows about the weight gain and the fluid retention and the bone thinning and lots of other complications, high blood pressure. And then with azathioprine, again, there were some toxicity studies in animals, but in humans, we don't have good data on that.
Okay. And then, you know, what are some issues that might occur during pregnancy in someone with issues like paralysis or muscle weakness? For example, you know, an increase in bladder issues or urinary tract infections, pressure sores, you know, autonomic dysreflexia, and other things. Dr. Bove?
Yeah, you've named them. So bladder issues are very common. Women have to go to the bathroom frequently. They are carrying sort of a higher water load in their bodies. And if there is sort of pressure on the bladder and a higher water load, bladder symptoms can become worse during pregnancy. And just to flag an issue for later, I commonly have women during their pregnancy schedule postpartum pelvic floor physical therapy to get an early handle on improving the bladder issues. We can get back to that later. In terms of pain and things like that, it's interesting. There are, relapses and inflammation, women can have sort of sensory changes and pain, but it's also important to note that other aspects of pregnancy can cause things similar. So women can get restless legs during pregnancy, they can get carpal tunnel, they can get other manifestations of, where there is either pain or tingling or numbness. And so sometimes it's a little bit more challenging to figure out if that's a consequence of their neurologic condition or if that's a normal pregnancy effect. And that carries over also into the postpartum period where women can get sort of pain in their upper back. That's called, it's from hunching around the baby. It's called adoring mother syndrome, or they can get numbness in their wrists from lifting the baby in a different way. And so it's really important, again, to kind of have a good sense of what their baseline neurologic function is and what are common neurologic changes during pregnancy so that they can really figure out, what's the pregnancy and what's the neurologic condition.
Now, Dr. Levy, if somebody were to relapse during pregnancy, would it be safe for them to receive an MRI?
MRIs are generally safe during pregnancy if they don't add contrast. The problem is that if we think you're relapsing and we need to get an MRI to confirm it, usually it's the contrast that helps us distinguish between old lesions and active lesions. So we're usually going to want the contrast, and the radiologists are going to tell us, no, you can't use contrast. So we're going to have to use a non-contrast scan and our best clinical judgment. Sometimes we don't want to take any risk with the gadolinium contrast, and we'll just treat empirically. And if we start treating and things get better, then we use that as a clue that there was a real relapse. If it's an obvious attack, for example, if you've never had vision problems in your right eye and then you wake up while pregnant, you wake up one morning and you can't see out of your right eye, we don't need an MRI in that situation. We can treat clinically. So there are some conditions where we don't even need the MRI. But if we need it, we would get it without contrast, and that's perfectly safe to do.
All right. And then Dr. Bove, so, if someone maybe was diagnosed with a condition, as a child and developed scoliosis as an effect of that, and they had to have a fused spinal cord, does this affect a pregnancy?
Yeah, I was hoping you wouldn't ask me because I don't know.
No problem. Dr. Levy, do you know?
Can you repeat that question?
Sure, of course. So, if someone was diagnosed with something like transverse myelitis or, acute flaccid myelitis as a kid and then developed scoliosis and then had to get a fused spinal, fused spine for that to treat the scoliosis, would this potentially affect a pregnancy?
I don't see how it would unless there's something related. It depends on the level of disability, I suppose. If this was something that impacted the person's ability to walk and to carry and to function, then maybe. But if you're asking immunologically, if there was some complication that could arise down the line on fertility, I don't think I'd see any reason why there would be one.
Now, Dr. Bove, does age play a factor with these diseases and trying to conceive?
Absolutely. So one of the things that's been a little bit difficult in sorting out whether these conditions are associated with pregnancy complications is that usually, you know, women who were, you know, it takes a little bit of time for these conditions to manifest and for women to be diagnosed with them. And so women who are getting pregnant with these conditions tend to be a little bit older than the general population. And so that's made it hard to figure out whether it's their condition that is associated with, you know, pregnancy issues or whether it's just age itself. So in these conditions, I think that's again where I really like to have my patients have a, you know, obstetrician and or a fertility expert on board, because as women get older, you know, you have a little bit less wiggle room in terms of how long you might wait before considering, you know, assisted reproductive technologies. And so that is a consideration. And then also in terms of, you know, what we call the comorbidities. So as women get older, they're at risk for more pregnancy complications in general. They may have high blood pressure. They may have other consequences of their therapies. And so all of those are sort of more, you know, can require just a little bit more monitoring and care during the pregnancy. And so often if a woman's 35 or above, or just because of her condition, I might have her see a maternal fetal medicine expert just to make sure that everything is optimized.
Got it. And I know you talked a little bit about this earlier, but you know, what research has been done on how pregnancy hormones and, you know, post-pregnancy hormones may affect an autoimmune disease, such as increasing the prevalence of, you know, disease after delivery, Dr. Bove?
Yeah, so again, this is mainly information from NMO. Okay, because with ADEM or with MOG, there's just fewer patients and sort of less is known about them. But what we have seen is in several groups of several hundreds of women with NMO now, we have seen that, again, there is a higher risk of relapses during the pregnancy, and then there's especially a higher risk of relapses in the first 3 months after pregnancy. That is presumed to be because as the hormone levels shift and then drop after delivery, the shifts in the hormones can lead to shifts in the immune cells. And, you know, the body is sort of like, okay, well, you know, the fetus is out of us, let's rev back our immune system into gear, and the immune system can trigger a relapse. To your question about what has been done about the hormones specifically, we don't really have a good handle yet on whether it's the estrogen, progesterone combinations or something else that's really the culprit. Research from the MS world has, you know, at different times implicated the pregnancy estrogens. So the pregnancy estrogen estriol or the other estrogens, estradiol, and also progesterone. There have been trials that have tried to sort of mimic those hormones and sort of to give back some of those hormones to women to try to, you know, ease that postpartum period. It hasn't been super successful, actually. And so I think it's probably going to be more complicated than just an estrogen question or just a progesterone question. There's also the placenta itself that sends all kinds of signals throughout the body, beyond just those two hormones. And finally, you know, breastfeeding has its own sort of whole cascade of signaling hormones associated with breastfeeding. And so I think we're going to find that the answer is a bit more complicated, and there's a lot of work to be done in that area. For patients who are sort of, you know, considering, you know, a pregnancy and delivery, I think the bottom line for someone today might be that that postpartum period would be a period where there could be a higher risk of relapses and where they should just be managed very carefully.
Now, this question's for both of you. My OBGYN preferred a vaginal versus a cesarean. Would you guys prefer one over the other? Dr. Libby, would you like to go first?
I would not recommend one over the other. I would defer to the obstetrician. There may be other reasons that an obstetrician may recommend one over the other, but from a neurological point of view or immunological point of view, I don't see a distinction, really.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with Dr. Levy. So in most cases, it's really the obstetric indications that guide, you know, what happens. We have seen some obstetricians prefer a cesarean because they felt it was more of a controlled scenario. That may be right, but it may be also putting the mom at sort of risk of operation and having wound care in addition to everything else after she's delivered. We have seen some anesthesiologists who were worried about giving moms epidurals because they were worried that that would trigger relapses and flares. In the MS world, at least, the data have been pretty conclusive that epidurals do not cause MS relapses or anything else. And so, again, there, the decision for a cesarean or vaginal birth, this decision for epidural versus other anesthesia or no pain relief at all, are typically based on, you know, sort of the obstetric needs.
Now, Dr. Bove, are you at higher risk for possibly relapsing due to having a cesarean versus a vaginal?
We don't know that for NMO or certainly any of the other rarer conditions. We have seen that from an MS standpoint, no. The cesarean versus vaginal birth does not affect risk of relapses postpartum.
Great. Thank you both. And then, you know, talking about post, you know, birth and what medications are safe to take, for example, while breastfeeding, Dr. Levy.
So we'll start with the immunological medicines. Rituximab does get excreted in the breast milk. It's probably broken down in the baby's stomach and can't be absorbed anyway because it's not the right type of antibody. So there is probably no harm in breastfeeding even after you receive a course of rituximab. With the other medications, I'm not aware. I'll defer to Dr. Riley in case she knows, Dr. Bove in case she knows of reasons why you should not breastfeed on the other immune medications. And same goes for the symptomatic meds, so pain meds, anti-seizure drugs, all of those medications may also be excreted in the breast milk, and there may be some concern about the baby in contact with medication, whether or not that causes enough harm to be contraindicated. I'm not sure. Dr. Bove?
Yeah, so I would definitely agree with you about the rituximab. So we've actually been looking at the amounts of rituximab in breast milk, and they're really, 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 really tiny. So whereas there are, you know, trace amounts, they're so small that it probably, you know, is okay for women to sort of cautiously take that medicine and, you know, breastfeed. The other medicines, I want to make a fairly blanket statement, which is that there has not been anywhere near the level of adequate research in this area. For all intents and purposes, whenever you look at clinical trials, clinical studies of any kind, women who are pregnant or breastfeeding are basically excluded from the research. And so that's really sort of a blind spot in medicine in general. It's a blind spot where our patients are concerned. And so a lot of what we say is very is iffy because we just don't have the adequate level of information. And again, I think that's where thinking about whether it makes sense that a medication would cross into breast milk and what the consequences to the baby would be. I would say there's a great site for women who are thinking about all the symptomatic therapies and all the sort of immune therapies. It's LactMed, and they put and I'm happy to sort of distribute the link to you guys, but they do put their best updated information there. But even that information is really, really limited. In general, the sort of OB and neonatal literature does seem to be okay with steroids and breastfeeding as well, just because the amounts that get to the baby are very, very, very are low and are not enough to necessarily cause symptoms in the baby.
Okay, thank you. Now, Dr. Levy, what are the chances of our offspring developing any of these demyelinating diseases?
If they do, I want to know about it right away so I can do genetic sequencing on the family, because that would be very rare. There is a slightly increased risk of transmitting MS if one family member has it, but with NMO, there is none that I'm aware of. In fact, I think there are fewer cases where we have NMO within families than would be expected, even just by numbers. So maybe it's even rarer to have someone in the family with NMO. With transverse myelitis, we found a gene. We published on it this year. It's still pretty rare, but we found 8 people so far who have a genetic mutation that can be passed down, but it's very hard to. Both parents have to have the genetic mutation, and then there's only 1 in 4 risk of passing that down to the child. So familial forms of these conditions are very, very, very rare.
Okay, thank you. And then I have a question that comes from someone with NMO. They had a crisis during their pregnancy in 2006. They didn't have a diagnosis. But they, because of the pregnancy, chose to avoid steroids until after they'd given birth, which meant waiting, 3 to 4 months before any medications could be given. So during this pregnancy, they developed bladder urgency and an overactive bladder, and having to go to the bathroom a lot of times in the middle of the night. And so they were just wondering if there's anything they can do to help this, other than just the advice to not drink too much, right before bed. Dr. Bove?
Yeah, so first of all, that's just from a quality of life standpoint, that's just horrible. We know that when people are up at night with overactive bladder, they're at risk of falling on their way to the bathroom. So there's a whole protocol that needs to happen to make sure there's a nightlight and other things so that they're going to the bathroom safely. For men, it's a little bit easier if they have a urinal at bedside, but for women, you got to get up and go unless you're wearing, depends. And then in terms of what to do about it, and then the other piece is, of course, that sleep interruption then leads to daytime fatigue and mood changes and difficulty with attention and all those other things, which just makes life a lot more miserable. So in terms of what to do about it, the first line here is really pelvic floor physical therapy, and really going not to a general physical therapist who may not be familiar with the interventions, but really to a place that's expert in pelvic floor physical therapy. So if the neurologist doesn't know a good place, the OBs often do know a good place. And that's where they really evaluate all of the different pelvic floor muscles and figure out exactly what the issue is. The urologists can also do what's called urodynamic studies, where they look at what's working and what's not working, and can sort of recommend medications. But the medication should be second line. The first line should be physical therapy. For people who don't want to take medications or for whom the medications are not enough, there are also a number of other interventions that can be helpful. And so one of those is actually, sounds a little bit funny, but it's stimulating the tibial nerve. So it's kind of zapping a nerve down in the leg, and that through sort of a series of sort of feedback loops tells the bladder to calm down a little bit, and that can be very effective. And so that's something that the pelvic floor physical therapist and the urologist would sort of guide. Something else can be urologists do sometimes put Botox into the bladder. So yeah, we're talking about the Botox that's used for cosmetic purposes, but it also can be very helpful in relaxing the bladder and sort of reducing some of that urgency and overactive bladder phenomenon. And so there's actually a range of things that you can do. Again, the medicines, but also more importantly, the pelvic floor physical therapy work, so sort of Kegels plus, and then also the nerve stimulation, and maybe Botox can help.
Dr. Levy, now how can physicians stop exacerbations and lower autoimmune conditions postpartum pregnancy?
I'm not sure I understand the question. You mean after you deliver, what treatment options are available for preventing attacks?
Yes.
After pregnancy, basically we consider that to be a safe time for trying anything, going back to Cellcept, Rituxan, whatever you were on before is what we would do. We don't necessarily see it as the pregnancy having caused any permanent change to your immune system or otherwise. So it would be just as if you weren't pregnant, having been pregnant. We would just go back to the original therapies that we've been recommending.
Thank you. And as we're getting to the end of our time, I did have a question that came in during the podcast from someone asking about pregnancy after ADEM or acute disseminated encephalomyelitis for someone who had an adult onset case of ADEM rather than ADEM as a child. Do either of you have experience seeing a patient who has this diagnosis with pregnancy?
I don't have experience seeing a patient with this diagnosis in pregnancy. There have been a few cases of ADEM reported after a pregnancy, but ADEM is, as you know, most typically considered a one-time thing where recurrences are rare. So if a person had ADEM in their past, they may not necessarily have another experience ever, including postpartum. That said, it is probably a good idea to watch women carefully and to get an MRI, a really good MRI before the pregnancy, so that if there were any changes during pregnancy and you couldn't use the contrast, you could still evaluate whether there had been new spots that formed, and also just, have a good, make sure that the neurologist has a good sense of how the patient is doing so that they could really be on top of evaluating any changes.
Now, is there anything else either one of you guys would like to add?
The only thing I would add to the ADEM answer is that for anyone who has an adult onset or who has recurrent ADEM, we recommend checking for the MAGA antibody because those patients who have MRIs that are typical for ADEM, especially in adults and who have relapsing courses, will often test positive for MAGA antibody, and we don't want to miss that because it's treatable now. So that's something to be wary of.
Thank you. And Dr. Bove, anything to add just about the topic in general?
No, it's a really exciting life transition for women. I think with very careful planning and careful monitoring, most women can do really, really well in terms of achieving a pregnancy and then also sort of having, good outcomes neurologically. And so it's just a really good time to be very connected with the healthcare system, to be connected with familial supports and, other supports in the community. And to just plan carefully.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. We also want to thank Andrea Mitchell and the folks at the MOG Project for their help with this podcast as well. And of course, Ashley for moderating. So thank you all so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.